This is an oral history interview with Eile Mar Trip, conducted on the 13th of May, 2013, by Crawford Young. Eile, let's start with the origins of your intellectual journey. And you had a, compared to most people, unusual childhood, growing up in Africa. In a way, you were predestined to be an Africanist from your both your parental careers and your own childhood years. Could you speak to the influence on your subsequent intellectual development of your parents, and then spending your early years mostly in Tanzania?
Sure. Well, I have been very heavily influenced by my parents. My mother had gone to Tanzania in 1952 as a teacher of teachers, and she actually taught the first generation of women teachers who then married into the Tanzanian elite. And they themselves married the people who became then the leaders of the country, and including the wife of the president, Nyerere. And then she married my father. I was born in England, actually, in Market Harborough in Leicestershire. And he had been doing refugee work there after the war. There was Latvians and Estonians and Lithuanians who fled to Great Britain. And so then he went and continued to do refugee work in Tanzania. SWAPO was based in Tanzania at the time. So he worked with them, with Namibians, and worked in the area of education. He also had a congregation, an English congregation, at the Azania Front Lutheran Church in Dar es Salaam. So they went there in 1960, so I was 2 years old when I went there. And I grew up at a very kind of heady time in Tanzanian politics. It was very exciting. At that time, it was very hopeful too. It left a real impression on me. And also the kinds of people that my parents interacted with, I think it also had an impact on me. My mother worked with the YWCA then later on when we were children. I had two sisters that were, one of whom was born in England and one was born in Tanzania. And so my mother then, when she was raising us, she was no longer a teacher, but she worked for a while with the YWCA. And then after that, she got her PhD at University of Uppsala, and she became an anthropologist, building on her earlier work as an ethnologist. Let's see where to go with this. Anyway.
They were both of Finnish.
Right, extraction. So she was Finnish, so I grew up then speaking Finnish. It was my mother tongue, Swahili, because all my friends spoke Swahili, and then English because of my father, and also Tanzanian. The schooling system was in English, and I went to the Bunge Primary School, which was it was a Tanzanian government school for my primary school, and then I went for a few years to international school there in Dar es Salaam. But in the course of all of that, I got to know made a lot of connections, obviously, that I was able to then draw on later on in my research. And a lot of the people that we interacted with were people who were, like I said, became the elites, and so political elites. We lived, for example, in the house of one of the members of parliament. Our neighbor was a member of parliament. Mm-hmm. We had, our friends were, you know, a lot of them were partly church people, but also partly people who were active in the politics at the time. My mother also taught at the university. She engaged me later on in her own research, and that's where I learned to do research. She took me on lots of her trips. We lived in a part of the time in a village 30 miles outside of Dar es Salaam, and so I saw really firsthand how one does, you know, research and interviews. And I took notes for her. I typed up her dissertation. I got a real sense of things. But I spent my weekends going to initiation ceremonies, weddings, coming burials, exorcisms, divinations, all of these things. And of course, I thought that was what you do on the weekend. But that's where I think that's where I really got my first real experience with what field work was about and how to go about it and how to talk to people. So I learned really from the best. What else should I say? My father was also very interested in the history of Tanzania, and so we spent also our weekends going and looking at there every 5 miles or so up the Tanzanian coast, all the way up to Somalia, there are these trading posts, and some of them were large ones like Kilwa, Kunduchi, Msasani, and so on. But then there were lots of small ones that aren't even recorded anywhere. And so we would go and we would find pottery from the Ming Dynasty. We'd find pottery from the 11th century from Persia. Mm-hmm. We'd find slave beads that were used in the slave trade. And they're just all along these lagoons that are on the way up there. So I actually wrote my first dissertation when I was 11 years old on Chinese maritime trade with the East African coast.
Oh, my goodness.
Anyway, so those were some of the influences.
Prophetic beginning.
Yeah.
So you, with your parents of Finnish extraction, you actually were born in UK. How did you get to the United States?
Well, my father is born actually here near Racine in Wisconsin, and then he had gone after the war back. He'd been based in England during the war, went back there, and he had met my mother actually in Minneapolis because she'd gone to a theological seminary there and had met her, met him when he was going through his theological training there, and so I'm a combination of American and Finnish heritage, and I have a dual citizenship in both countries. Mm-hmm. There was always a thought that I actually didn't go to school. I finished my school in eighth grade, and then I went. In Tanzania, there were very limited opportunities for expatriates to go to the secondary school, and most were Brits, so they went to boarding schools in the UK. Mm-hmm. And the Americans had a little bit of a harder time. There weren't many of us, and some of them went to these very conservative religious institutions in Nairobi or Madagascar, but my parents felt they were too conservative, and so I went to I did my high school through correspondence, probably the first version of online learning, and I finished when I was 14. So then I had, after I was 14, then I did spend some time, like I said, with my mother going around, helping her with her research. I spent 1 year in Helsinki studying French and going to the university. I took courses at the university in Helsinki, but not for credit, but I just took a variety of courses, and I studied music. I played the flute and the piano. And then I went back again another year in Tanzania. Then when I was 16, I came to go to college at Luther College, which is where my father had gone after the war. He had been able to put himself through with the GI Bill, and both my uncle and father had gone there, and they really wanted me to go to a good Lutheran school. So I went there for 2 years, and I got married after 2 years, and my husband finished up, and so we then took a hiatus. He went, I went to work for a little bit, and he went to medical school, and then I went back to school at University of Chicago, and I finished up there.
So, I see. So just the last couple of years.
2 years, right.
University of Chicago.
Right, and then I was there also for my master's another 2 years.
Any special intellectual influences during the BA, final BA years and the MA in Chicago?
Chicago, yeah. I took courses with Ralph Austin, who was a historian. And I was in political science, there wasn't anybody then working on Africa at the time in political science. I think for a little bit, what's his name? He just
Aristide
died now.
Solomon.
Yeah, he had just left or was leaving, in the process of leaving, and wasn't teaching. So Zolberg, I did know him, but I didn't take any classes with him. Mm-hmm. And then the Komarovs were a big influence on me, and I took courses with them. Mm-hmm. And then and Binder, Leonard Binder, was one of my advisors. Mm-hmm. He was my advisor. But then he left. I was going to study with him and continue the PhD with him, but he left then to UCLA, and so I then decided to go to Northwestern for my PhD because I had started in Middle East studies at... I got a master's in Middle East at University of Chicago and had started Arabic there, and then I continued at Northwestern. I'm not sure it was the best decision, but it because of where Warren was at, and we wanted to stay in that area. Mm-hmm. But I liked Northwestern. It was good. And I was able to continue with the Middle East with Ibrahim Abulugad, who was my advisor there initially.
What explains the detour via Middle East studies when you had all this early East African background?
Well, I think part of it was my mother was an anthropologist. She was well known in Europe as a Tanzania scholar, and I think I wanted to do something a little different and not just follow directly in her tracks. And I don't know if it was a conscious decision, but that was I think maybe subconsciously part of what it was. And I was also interested. I always felt that as much as Africa was misunderstood, I felt that the Middle East was even more misunderstood, and I felt that there was a real need to have people who were kind of cultural interpreters. But then I started working on my master's, which was on Libya's involvement in Chad, and I felt like one should... I felt that Libya was really, at that time, and really up until 2006, Libya was involved in practically every conflict in Africa. I mean, yeah. They had their hand in everything, and they were funding both sides, and it just... It hadn't been researched, and I was going to go that route. And then when it finally came down to actually doing the dissertation, I got cold feet, and I thought, no, I can't, they're going to nab me as a spy, and, that'll be the end of me. And so I felt it's better to do something, and in Tanzania, I had all these connections. I had, all this access. I knew the language. It was really, it was much, much easier, and it just felt easier. I also would have had to learn colloquial Arabic, which would have taken another year. Uh-huh. And so, because anywhere you work, you have to then learn in the local Amiya, the local Arabic. And all I had was classical, and so that would have been another year.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So. Yeah, well, Libya was not a very easy place to do research in.
No.
In high cut-off times.
No. I mean, Lisa Anderson did, but I don't think she spent much time there. I think, it was more from afar.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
There were a few.
So, anybody at Northwestern who was especially influential?
Yeah, so I worked... Ibrahim Abulugad was, to a certain extent, I took initially courses with him, but then I switched to work with Ron Herring, and I'm not even sure why that was, but somehow it wasn't anything. Ibrahim stayed on my committee, but it may. I'm not really sure. I think it was maybe because I was moving more into kind of political economy questions, and Ron Herring had a background in that, and he really seemed familiar with the literature that I was engaged in, and I also worked very closely with Evelyn Stevens. She changed her name later to Evelyn Huber, but at the time she was Evelyn Stevens. And they were wonderful. I mean, they were just fabulous, all of them. Also, Karen Hansen in anthropology was on my committee. Mm-hmm. And they all provided very different kinds of input, but they were really good. And they were useful because they pushed me to think about things in comparative perspective rather than just looking at it from an African perspective. So it was useful that way.
Mm-hmm.
They were very supportive.
So when you finished your Northwestern PhD, your first job was with the MacArthur Foundation.
Uh-huh.
How did you wind up there rather than the conventional academic route?
Well, I started while I was writing my dissertation. And so I was there about a year. Yeah, I was there the whole time. And then I ended with them when I finished my dissertation. Or somewhere, I forget exactly at what point, but at some point there I finished while I was there. I got the job, I believe, through Kenneth Benedict, who was married to Jay Casper, who was the chair of our department, and they were looking for two students. Mm-hmm. And so I applied and I got the job, and I was basically a program officer. I was called a research associate, but what I did was the work of a program officer, and I developed their program in Africa, and I got to travel. It was amazing for somebody who's just coming out of college or out of a PhD. I got to travel all over Africa. I met... I had known as a child, what's his name? Sam Nujoma, who was became the first president of Namibia. Oh, but I got to meet him again, and he was like, "Oh, Eiley, I haven't seen you for 20 years." So I met him. We met Mugabe. We met Chissano. We met. We were in South Africa the day that Mandela got released from Robben Island. I mean, it was It was exciting. It was an exciting time to be working with the. With MacArthur and working on this program, and it was primarily based in Southern Africa, and we ended up, one of the things we did was a community development foundation in Mozambique that was together with Graça Machel, who then later married Mandela, but she was at the time very active in more as a figurehead, a political figure, not so much in politics herself, in Mozambique at the time.
So, had it always been your ambition and intention to return to the academic world?
I never intended not to. I mean, that was the MacArthur thing was just in between. It wasn't a. It was not a.
Career decision.
It was not a career decision at all. It was just a filler.
Mm-hmm. So, in. 1991, when you actively were looking for positions, I assume you had other opportunities besides UW-Madison.
Yeah, I got a job at where was it? There were only a few openings. I think I applied to four jobs and I got two of them. One was at University of Denver in their International Studies School, and I got that one, and then I got this one, which kind of popped up at the last minute, I think, and I think I interviewed very late. It was April. I then turned the other one down and came here. And the funny thing is, this is very strange, but we had always felt like we should be in Madison, Warren and I. We'd even come up at one point, it just sounds very silly because you can only, you know, the number of jobs you can get in academia just where you want to be is really, remote. Anyway, but my aunt had always said she lived in Janesville, and she was like, of course you're going to get a job in Madison, of course. I mean, so we came up one time, we came a few years when I was in grad school. My mother taught here actually 2 years at the Women in the Gender Studies program. And in the summer school in there. So I came up to see her. And at the same time, we met Fireman and his wife, Liz. And she was a doctor. He was an academic. We thought, okay, see what it's like to be here. And we liked it. And we thought, okay, that's where we're going to end up.
And you did.
And
my goodness. And, it was kind of an accident that there were a couple of positions, a couple of appointments we could make in African politics at the time.
Yeah.
Because Mike Schatzberg was hired.
Right.
Either the same year or the year before.
No, the same year.
The same year.
Right.
And you have been with UW since that time. Now, when you arrived, I believe you had a little girl already.
Right. She was, a few years old. She was born 1988, so she was about 3 years old.
And then subsequently you had a son. Why don't you say a few words about the challenges of combining parenting kinds of pressures to make tenure and so forth in your first academic years. That's been an issue of much discussion, and what sorts of accommodations are appropriate and needed for that and so forth.
Yeah.
How did you manage that that difficult period?
No, it was hard, and I don't remember sleeping very much in those early years anyway, which I think was hard to, from that point of view, it was difficult, but also the kids were a great distraction as well. I mean, they were wonderful, my tendency is to kind of work too much, and so it was always wonderful to have you know, kids that could then take you away from that and put you in a completely different world and a different frame of mind. So it worked both ways. But I do remember that, especially with Layla, and especially having Lloyd right before tenure, I think that I remember feeling that that was very hard. Mm-hmm. And but on the other hand, I couldn't have waited much longer, otherwise they wouldn't have had a Lloyd. So mm-hmm. it was, there wasn't really much choice. That you know, that unfortunately the tenure clock is the same as the mm-hmm. the biological clock, and so you have to kind of, you know, it's a bit of, it's a challenge for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So in when you first came, your appointment was entirely in the department. The additional appointment in gender studies came a little later, did it?
No, it was both. I was always a joint appointment, 50-50, with a tenure in political science.
Maybe, I guess that's one of the reasons why yeah. we were able to make a second appointment.
Right.
Because gender studies was right. looking for somebody right. in women in development.
Exactly. And so it, mm-hmm. it worked out that way, yeah.
Well, let's start with the department. What... Mm-hmm. What are your perceptions of how the department has evolved, prospered or not prospered?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
What were the high and low points in your departmental years?
I mean, I think right now we're doing really well, but we did have a little bit of a slump a few years ago, maybe 6 years ago, when we lost a lot of faculty, and it was looking rather grim mm-hmm. Because of some of the budgetary cuts that were taking place, but now we've seemed to have hired a really strong cohort of mm-hmm. Junior faculty who are really, you know, publishing a lot, are very visible in the field, are, you know, they're doing good work. But when I hired in, the department was, you know, it was much older. Everybody was over mm-hmm. 60, it seemed, and Lee Payne and myself seemed, you know, there was this big kind of a gap in age between the, mm-hmm. the junior faculty and the senior faculty. It was, and now mm-hmm. I think we have a much broader range of in terms of age.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think in that sense, it's a younger department now.
Mm-hmm.
Intellectually, what seems to have changed is that people tend to be doing now, I mean, we've kind of gone the direction of the whole discipline, and there's much more emphasis now, and some will say it's for the better, and it is, I guess. There's much more emphasis on methods and on, you know, that kind of methodological rigor, and that we've put that into our graduate training, made that much more prominent, and so I think that will help in terms of getting people jobs. On the other hand, I think that the kind of research that one sees that's coming, that often comes along with that kind of focus is, it's much narrower in focus. People take a small question and they mm-hmm. they fiddle with it around the corners, and you don't have the yeah. kind of intellectual breadth that I think that came with the people like yourself and Michael Schatzberg and others, that you don't have that kind of broader intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. So it's a trade-off, and it's sometimes it's frustrating, but you know, in other respects, it's you know, people who do their work, they do it very well. They use multiple methods, most of them. They don't just do mm-hmm. Statistical studies, at least in comparative. They do a lot of different things. So
mm-hmm.
it's a changing field.
Mm-hmm. And how about the gender and women's studies mm-hmm. department? You've been as active in that department as in the political science?
Yeah, probably more so because I also was the director for the Center for Research on Gender and Women for so long, mm-hmm. since 2000. And so I've been very active in that department. That one has changed even more. We used to be primarily made up of joint appointments, and now, I don't know the exact numbers, but a large percentage now, maybe even the majority, have full-time appointments mm-hmm. in gender mm-hmm. studies. We also went from being a program to a department, so mm-hmm. that gave us a little bit of a different standing. We initiated a master's program, so all of these things have changed the department really quite dramatically. But what it has created, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but there's a bit of all the people who are the full-time appointments are almost all junior faculty, and then all the rest of us, Janet Hyde and myself uh-huh. and uh-huh. Susan Friedman and others, are these joint appointments. And so there's a little bit of there's no tension or anything, but it's just a different perception of things.
Well, yes, you would think it would be, since if you have 1 foot in a mainstream department
right.
and its intellectual culture,
right.
and then gender studies is a somewhat distinctive
right.
Field in its priorities and its orientation and
right.
so forth.
Right. But I should just say one thing that I've, one of the best things about being in gender studies is that that's, I think, where most of my kind of intellectual collaborations have been based. So I mm-hmm. work very closely with Myra Marks-Faree, who's in sociology. Mm-hmm. She's one of the best scholars on social movements. I worked with Christina Ewig, who's both in gender studies and political science, but primarily her tenure home is in gender studies. And mm-hmm. so we've been able to publish many books together and do conferences and do colloquia. And we did last year the Sawyer seminar for the whole year on mm-hmm. globalization and women's rights. So it's been, I think, in terms of intellectual engagement, much of mine has been interdisciplinary, and it's been outside the department rather than inside the department. Mm-hmm. Whereas and that was the other big change in political science, was that it became much more insular. That in the past there were many more engagements across. You know, if you think back, Lee Payne and Paul Hutchcroft and others were involved in research circles across campus. And with people in many different departments. Now there's the intellectual activity mm-hmm. and the life is, it's a lot of it, but it's all within the department yeah. with through the colloquia. And it's good. I mean, it's not a bad thing, but there's a trade-off in terms of, again, the breadth issue.
Now, when I first read the manuscript of your first major book, Changing the Rules, as I was reading it, I did not perceive it to be a contribution primarily in gender studies, but uh-huh. in classical political science.
Right.
Perhaps there wasn't gender studies existing at Northwestern at the time.
There was, and I, in fact, one of my advisors was Jenny Mansbridge, and she had she was a big influence on me as well. She was also on my committee. But I did not apply here actually for a gender studies position initially, and then I think this one. But there was, I don't quite know how it all happened, but I think that there was the perception that because I had written some articles on kind of the women's role in the informal economy, that I had that interest. But I was not actually trained in, I'd never taken any courses, and so okay, maybe I'm a charlatan. but it was I think it was how the job evolved.
Mm-hmm. So, how about your connections with the African Studies program? How significant have they been?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very. I've been very, very engaged, especially up until the point where they scheduled our political science meetings against the Wednesday noon colloquium that began. That there was a bit of a time period there where I wasn't as involved. But no, I've been very involved. Even when I first came, I organized a conference through African Studies on women and democratization in Africa uh-huh. in 1994, and they were very helpful in organizing that. And I think I give a talk in the program almost every year. Mm-hmm. So I've been involved. I've been on a lot of the committees, and mm-hmm. A lot of my friends are involved in African Studies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You also had a year or two as Associate Dean of mm-hmm. International Studies.
Yeah, I think
How
it was four years.
Four
or more.
Four years.
Might have even been more. 4 years. Yeah, that was a very different experience. That exposed me a lot to how the university worked, and I got a better sense of the overall. I got to work with Global Health Program and with people in education and in the Ag School. So I got a much broader, I already had a lot of connections, but I was able to really use them, and I learned a lot about the university in that during that time.
Mm-hmm. And, well, let's turn to your research contributions, which are very numerous
mm-hmm.
and most impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one way to walk through that is to look for the connecting threads that mm-hmm. tie your mm-hmm. your work together, moving from Changing the Rules mm-hmm. to your comparative studies of women and their political role mm-hmm. across Africa.
Right. I mean, I think the connecting thread in most of this is really the role of society and the way that it's impacted politics. A lot of the research in political science is focused on, at least when I started, was focusing on the state. And the state, sometimes even as a very monolithic actor. And so, and to my mind, a lot the untold story really was how society was impacting. Even if you had these very autocratic states, it wasn't like they were completely unaffected by societal actors. And mm-hmm. so, in changing the rules, there I showed how the informal economy itself was pushing policy and pushing the forcing the state to make changes. A lot of the research had looked at the role of the World Bank and the IMF and how they were shaping macroeconomic change, but there were also pressures from below, and some of them were responses to crisis and to structural adjustment, but some of them were really efforts to try to to cope, but in the same time they were changing the way that the Tanzanian government behaved. And so that was the impetus in that project. When I then took the job here, I felt that as somebody working in gender studies, I need to learn more about gender studies. And so I felt that looking at women in politics in Africa would be one way to do that. And it seemed that in all the countries in Africa, and my perception was correct, at least I think it was correct, that Uganda was where there was the most happening at the time in the early 90s in terms of women's rights. And so I went, I did a project there and the book Women in Politics, and I also did an edited volume on women's movements in Uganda. And I looked at I wanted to know why that was happening. And what I discovered, but what I also have, I mean, it now fits a whole broader pattern. So at the time, I attributed it to the autonomy of the women's organizations, changes that happened during the war, and the role of the donors and so on. But if you now look in retrospect at what's happened in all the post-conflict countries, Uganda was the first, and you look at all of them now, Liberia, Mozambique, Ethiopia, you see the same pattern emerging in all of them. And so Uganda was the first to have a large increase in women's representation in parliament, first to 18%, and then now it was 39% at one point. Now it's 35. But you saw that pattern, and now it's been replicated in mostly the post-conflict countries. You have a few countries like Senegal, which are not post-conflict per se, where you've seen that same pattern. But most of them are post-conflict countries. So it really had something to do with the kind of changes that took place during the conflict and the opportunities that were presented by the new order that came into being. African Women's Movements was a collaborative book that I wrote with Alice Mungwa, Joy Kwesika, and Isabel Casimiro, and we looked at the same kinds of phenomena, but by the time we wrote that book, a lot more had changed on the continent, so there was a lot more to write about. Mm-hmm. And so we focused on Uganda, Cameroon, and Mozambique, partly because we wanted to look at just look at different Anglophone, Lusophone, and Francophone country. But I don't think the colonial legacy was such an important one, even though that's how we initially started off with the book. But that also picked up on many of these different changes, especially the ones that were taking place in the post-conflict countries. And we were able to document the kind of changes in constitution making, in legislative, in legislatures, legal reform, and so on relating to women. And then the Ugandan, the book on Museveni is a little bit less about the societal impacts, although it's definitely there. So the thread doesn't quite pull all the way through that book. But that was an effort to look at hybrid regimes in Africa and really focus on them as a type of regime. A lot of the literature had focused on this kind of failed democracy. And there have been a few countries that kind of democratized and then... but a lot of the literature spent a lot of time really focusing on how this last democratic wave in Africa after the 1990s had really not delivered what it had promised. And So I looked at more at the other end of the spectrum. What happened to those countries that kind of inched out of being authoritarian regimes and became these hybrid regimes that are neither fully democratic nor fully authoritarian? And what is, you know, why don't they then become democratic? And why do they get just stuck in this mode of operation? And about 50% of African countries are in this, I would call hybrid, some leaning more towards authoritarianism, some leaning more towards democracy. And I would say Museveni's Uganda leans more towards the authoritarian end of the spectrum. But it's not the same as under Idi Amin. It's not the same as under Obote. And so that's the point of the book, that there were changes that took place. Civil society is more active. Media is more free. There are changes. There is pushback in the legislature. There is pushback in the judiciary. It is of consequence. It does matter. And so I've been looking at what difference do these regimes make? And then now I'm finishing up a book that will hopefully be done this summer. I wrote three books in between starting this one, but it did involve field work in Angola, in Liberia. Twice I went to Liberia, and then Uganda, and then I've also had Marie-Ange Bunga did the interviews in Congo for me, and so I've been looking at. Focusing primarily on the post-conflict countries and why they've had so many more changes with respect to gender, women's rights compared to the countries in Africa that have not gone through conflict. And this is not just an Africa-wide phenomenon. You see the same thing in Nepal and East Timor, but it's very temporally defined. So it happened primarily after the 1995 or so, which is, of course, corresponds to the changes in international norms having to do with women's rights. But the main dynamic is really what happens during the conflict and the changes that in societal changes and the changes in gender relations that take place during the conflict, and that then explains, I think, why we see these changes that are so rapid in these countries.
As I look back on changing the rules, the real eye opener for me was your analysis of how. The years of decline in the late 70s and 80s had, in a subtle way, reframed household relations since the declining real value of the salaries of the men who were employed by the state and so forth. And the rising returns from the informal sector in which the women were engaged reversed the economic contribution to the household of the two partners in the marriage, and with all kinds of implications. Now, it's intriguing to think of the way in which that in turn seems to have repercussions in the political world over time. I don't know if there is a direct connection between those two phenomena, but your work moved from the household level, in a sense. Not that there was only household issues in changing the rules, but to the focus on the summit level, not necessarily summit level, but to the political. Openly political process in your later work.
Right. Yeah, so again, the micro-macro linkages that I focused on in that, I think that's another thread that one could say goes throughout my work. But you're right, it wasn't just women, it was also children, and it was also the people, the elderly, those who were not tied to the state sector, who didn't have civil service jobs, who didn't have jobs in the Paris, any kind of formal job. It was... They were the ones that were really driving the economy and were the main source of household revenue. So
So, anything else you want to say about the research contributions?
No, I think that's. I mean, I could say a lot, but yeah, that's. I think that's fine.
We'll cover the main issues.
Yeah.
One of the things that is particularly impressive in your CV are the many pages devoted to the enormous amount of professional service that you've rendered. How you manage to do it all is beyond me. But anyway, you do. What if that stands out? Certainly, your recent term of service as African Studies Association president during a period of crisis in the association is one very important contribution. But there, I'm sure, several others that will that you'd like to highlight.
Sure. Yeah, that was, I mean, I knew that it was a difficult, it was going to be a difficult term as president, because I came in as vice president and I realized all of a sudden that the organization was on the verge of collapse, but I didn't quite know how bad things were until I got into it. And so the first thing I did as vice president was to write the policies and procedures of the organization, because I had this feeling that it was going to fall apart, and I had to have something there to bring it. If we were going to bring in a new secretary, they would have to know how things functioned. So I did. I spent a lot of time on that, and there were huge financial difficulties, and one doesn't need to belabor all of that. But the upshot was that I had ended up having to let go, because of the finances. We had to let go five people, and the executive director was. I have legal constraints on what I can say about her, but there were maybe if I just give one indication that our hotel bill went from $192,000 the year that she was in office to $15,000 the year that she wasn't. So maybe that tells someone something. We had no choice but to take the actions that we did, and the board was 100% behind me. And we ended up more or less rebuilding the organization from scratch. And now they've hired now back a new secretariat, much more professional. Mm-hmm. They're very well qualified. We've got a wonderful executive director, Suzanne Bazette, and Fumi Vogt has taken over as her assistant. Mm-hmm. Anyway, things are going well. We got the journals to be taken over by Cambridge University Press, and just took many measures to really get the organization back into shape. And I really feel quite confident now about it and very hopeful. I mean, there's still all kinds of little things, but these are minor compared to the kinds of issues that we were looking at. I mean, I was just like, oh no, here I could become president and it's all going to collapse on my watch. I mean, that was kind of the choice I had, and either I did something about it or I didn't. But it took a good part of the year, and so that's partly why my book got delayed. But anyway, it's done now, and I feel good about it. I got 3 standing ovations at the ASA conference, so I think people recognize what had happened. Other things. Well, one of the main things that I've done is I feel like I've tried to use the position that I have and the access that I've had to work with scholars in Africa, and I've done that in a number of different ways. One is through co-publishing with them and publishing in their journals. The other is, and in their publishing, I've published with Fountain Press in a number of occasions and University of Dar es Salaam Press. I've also been editing a book series with University of Wisconsin Press, and we've published works of many African women scholars who have won awards and done really well, and so I'm really proud of that. About half the books, if not more, are by African women scholars. And there's very, very little in the social sciences. There certainly have been African novelists, but to get that level of to get published at a university press and a good university press, I think there haven't been so many books. So Shireen Hasim, for example, won the Victoria Shuck Award of APSA. As a result of her publication of her book on South African women's movements in our series. Mm-hmm. And there have been others as well. We're publishing right now a very exciting book on by the wife of Kony, the very brutal warlord who came from northern Uganda. And so that will be a big hit when it comes out. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a very difficult book to read because it's because of the material, but it's interesting. So I've done that. Then I've been very active in the last few years, maybe last 4 years, first with the African Humanities Program of the ACLS. I've done grant training seminars throughout Africa with them, and now more recently I've been working with the SSRC's program as well, mm-hmm. with Carnegie. Funded by Carnegie, rather. And both programs, the SSRC and the ACLS one, are funded by Carnegie. The SSRC's one is newer. It's called the Next Generation of African mm-hmm. Scholars. So I've been able to help them get these off the ground and mm-hmm. and do a lot of the trainings in Tanzania, Uganda, Ghana, and Nigeria. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, now I'm working on a major initiative with the Gates Foundation, and I'm going to see Melinda Gates next week to talk about it. I've been working with her senior staff on it. They're going to put a large amount of money into women's movements in Africa. Cool. And so I've been kind of helping them think through the issues involved with that. So these are the ways in which I feel like I've been able to kind of use the access that I have to support scholarship in Africa. Mm-hmm. And scholarship by Africans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's an impressive roster of activity. Turning to your teaching contribution, what aspects of your teaching service have you found most rewarding?
I think I've enjoyed most of it, but I think the most rewarding has been working with graduate students, and I've had some really terrific grad students over the years. Many of whom we've shared also, starting with Gretchen Bauer and Linda Beck and many others, but more recently Alice Kong, now Taylor Price. But I think that that's perhaps the most rewarding because I learned so much from them, and you know, they're going to the field and coming, you know, engaging them on the kinds of issues that they're interested in, I think has been incredibly rewarding. Mm-hmm.
Any reflections on the university overall and your association with it?
I don't particularly, but I think that one of the things that I've liked about our university, and one difference that I see when I compare our situation with that of other places, because I do go around a lot and give talks, and so I've had a chance to see other institutions. And I think that one way in which we do stand out is that we are more interdisciplinary. And there has been much more cross-disciplinary engagement on campus, and it's valued and it's recognized. I even got invited to give a talk in the physics department once in their series on chaos theory, and I thought, they must have made a mistake, because I was looking at the rest of the seminars during the year, and they were all from the chemistry department and limnology and so on. And this was... Clint Sprout was mm-hmm. the one who invited me. And I wrote to him and I said, are you sure I'm in the right, that you have the right person? And he says, yes, of course I do. And he says, don't worry about how you fit in. We'll figure it out. Anyway, the whole place was filled with engineers and physicists and chemists, and they were really interested. I talked about women in Africa. And they were really interested, and they had all kinds of explanations for it was a fun discussion, but I don't think that you would find that kind of an engagement in other parts of, you know, other universities. Uh-huh. So I think that's been something that's unique about this university. The other thing that I've always liked is that people don't just shut themselves off and close the door and not engage others. I mean, that there is a sense people are engaged with their colleagues' work, and in our department, there's a lot of emphasis on commenting and engaging in the work of others, and so you see that also in these interdisciplinary mm-hmm. engagements. I just gave a talk a few weeks ago in a seminar on the gender in the diaspora with mm-hmm. Keisha Lindsay, and I got people came from all different departments, and I got so much feedback on this on my paper, and it was really fun. I mean, it was. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that you see that so much other places. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is there anything we've left out or we need to spend a little more time on?
Well, I think that one thing, since I talked mainly about my those who've influenced me the most in gender studies, I didn't really talk about you and the way that you've influenced me. But I think that, you know, part of what's been made it very rewarding to work in both departments, and why I don't feel like I could be just in one or the other, is because I've had, you know, such wonderful support and such, you know, really incredible colleagues. And I think that yourself, and especially yourself, but also Michael Schatzberg and now Scott Strauss, have been, you know, amazing supports and influences, you know, I just can't imagine a better arrangement. I think we all get along. We've had students together, and so I really, you know, I really, really sincerely enjoyed all of our collaborations. And I just, it's one of the reasons why, you know, people have tried to get me to go to, you know, Cornell has tried to recruit me, and University of Pennsylvania has tried to recruit me, but I, you know, I just can't see going to a place without, you know, the same set of colleagues. So, in the same kind of environment. So it's been, yeah.
Well, that's a good note on which to close.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Eileen. This concludes an oral history with Eileen Tripp.